The human life, according to the present expectancy tables, can be roughly divided into three parts. The first 25 years being considered youth, and now largely devoted to growing up and attaining an education. The second 25-year span we like to think of as maturity. Maturity in the sense that it presents the period of maximum physical resources and is associated with the problem of social adjustment. From the 50th year on, we come to what might be termed advancing years. Years in which, inevitably, our attitudes on subjects of living pass through modifications. Actually, therefore, the human being with a 75-year life expectancy lives three lives in this course of time. These lives can almost be considered separate existences. For while actually they are not accompanied by any startling transformations of appearance, they are accompanied by very startling transformations of attitudes. The individual changes his psychic polarization. This is perhaps a rather gradual procedure, may take several years, but it does inevitably come. And with it, there are transformations taking place within us, which have always occurred at these periods in the lives of human beings, which every generation has had to face, and which really constitute what we might term the basis of the generation concept, that generations follow each other according to certain natural time and age sequences. The first period that we are concerned with, we may say, is youth. This extends actually from birth to the achievement of maturity. Maturity itself is a very abstract kind of word. Perhaps we can best associate it with the concept that in any generation, maturity is adjustment with the mature life of that generation. Maturity does not necessarily mean that we have grown up. It means that we have leveled off according to the dominant psychological code of our day. We say that a large part of youth is adjustment, and this is essentially the basis of our psychological problem involving young people. They are trying to find out how to live. And from the earliest time, nature told them, through example, that the way to find out how to live was to watch the mature unit of their society and follow its leadership. Rabbits instinctively learn the secret of survival simply by watching their parents. The same is true of practically every wild animal and bird. There is no verbal communication, but from the reactions of the parent, the young gains a certain instruction. When the parent crouches down to remain invisible against some danger, the young follows and does the same thing. To fail in this is to die. And survival means to obey the example of the mature. There is no question that this is also the natural instinct of the human being. Growing up, he has to turn somewhere for guidance. He has to contemplate with his own inadequate and immature faculties the problem of his own survival. How is he going to grow up? How is he going to achieve his ultimate maturity? What can he do? What should he do? What must he not do? These are things that every young person wants to know. The great difficulty we have had in recent years is the confusion and disorientation of the so-called mature generation. Parents are not able to guide their own lives. They are not able to make their own decisions thoughtfully and wisely. They are unable to cope with the situations that arise in their own living. And therefore, they cannot set the examples and establish the patterns for their own young. Many parents, most parents, would like to. I think it is a mistake to assume that the average parent does not care. They do care. But they are just as bewildered as their children. And they lack one quality that the child possesses, and that is abundant energy. Therefore, in history and in psychology, we know that rebellion arises most rapidly in the young. First, because energy is more abundant, and secondly, because reason has not dulled the edge of action. The young person has not had enough experience to become afraid, become disillusioned, or accept the inevitability of futility. So what do we have as the problem of the young person today? We have a generation growing up essentially without leadership. I've had a good many younger people come to me, and while many of them, in a sense, enjoy lack of direction, they rather like the freedom of doing as they please. Very few of them believe in it as a philosophy of life. Most of them realize that something wrong is happening, but they do not know what it is. They are convinced that the world is not moving towards a practical achievement, that those who are creating and building our way of life know what they are creating or what they are building. And this insecurity must inevitably result in a great deal of nervous tension. If we could only give young people a reasonable measure of leadership, I believe they would accept it even now. But this leadership is not available. How are parents going to give leadership to their children when the parents themselves are going to psychologists and psychiatrists to try to put their own lives in order? Today, the mature generation that should set the example is in just as grave difficulties as the younger generation. Not knowing what to do with these young people, their confused elders are turning in every direction to find for these young people the support that is necessary for them. But the elders are turning to solutions they would not consider for themselves. They do not realize that false answers or solutions that do not solve cannot long hold the attention of the young. In the failure of the mature generation to meet its own responsibilities, it has also failed to support in society any structure that would be protective of young people. So today the parents turn to the churches for the instruction of their young. But most of them do not go to church themselves. Or if they do, have gained very little from it. And yet they expect the children to gain much. Another opportunity is education. Give the child education. Give it the opportunity to learn more, to build a better career. Yet many of the parents that are mentally confused and emotionally sick themselves are educated. Today we have more and more persons of brilliant minds falling apart. We used to feel that the educated person had tremendous securities and resources. Well, probably he did, under the conditions of a different generation. But today, your educated person is the most confused and uncertain of all. Some of the worst doctrines being circulated in human society today are being taught by college professors. The educated person experiences the strangest and most complicated futility of all. His education does not permit him to follow the old ways, nor does it provide him with a mental nature strong enough to make new ways that are important. So the educated person is in the position to suffer acutely. He has gained a sufficient skill to think, but not enough skill to think well. The young person graduating from the present educational facilities, therefore, is not assured of emotional maturity or intellectual integration. He is very fortunate if he graduates with as much integrity as he possessed when he was enrolled. He is fortunate if his educational structure does not contribute to his demoralization. So here we have the tension problems of youth. We have young people completely leaderless at a period of life in which they cannot lead themselves adequately. We find them, therefore, becoming emotionally unstable. We find an hysteria taking over a large part of their conduct. They are trying to escape into something or from something, taking the attitude that a tremendous immediate activity is the only solution to their problem, to forget themselves in some kind of a mood as strange and unhealthy as that of a Central African witch doctor. There is no integration here, no clear vision of value. This is true in the leadership of young nations coming up. The young nation has no mature nations to lead it or guide it. There is only a wide diversity of immaturities. Nothing is real, nothing is sensible, nothing is factual. In the presence of this confusion, we do have a great deal of willfulness. Willfulness which simply is a rebellion, not against parents, but against certain attitudes, certain basic patterns which arise in the parental environment. I think that many
children, young people, in their late teens or middle teens, could accomplish something for themselves if they would simply turn back on their parents and say, lead. Give us some strength. Tell us what we should be doing and make us do it. But the parent falls apart and will go under sedation if such a suggestion was made. They do not know what to do, what to say, how to lead. They do not even know what their children should believe because they do not know what to believe themselves. Their own generation was without adequate integration. Now this condition goes along and we have all kinds of strange and eccentric outbreaks. We have youth getting into difficulty more than we like. But gradually, this first great change begins to take place within the structure of youth itself. Young people are not primarily changed by the world. They are changed by psychophysical processes occurring within themselves. Little by little, the shadow of maturity begins to be noted on the faces of the young. Things are changing. Interests are changing. And there comes a time, and young people are very keenly aware of it today, when the young set tosses out the old person of 20. There has come this point where there is a sharp line of demarcation. The moment the individual begins to move into the maturity patterns, things begin to happen inside of his own economy. His interests change. And the great patterns of society, which have control for ages, begin to move in on him. He is no longer without some kind of leadership. Two or three executive forces begin to operate in his life. He comes under the one leadership, perhaps, that is still left to us. And it will be a bad day if we lose it. And that is the leadership of work. Somewhere along the way, it becomes apparent to the young person that he must make a life for himself. In this, he finds plenty of example around him. He knows that most other young people must find jobs, must create careers for themselves, must gain certain skills and proficiencies, and most of all, that in order to keep the job or to grow in the business, you have to begin to obey rules. So maturity is the end of this enchanting process of doing as you please. With it comes the inevitable pressures of necessity. In the early years of maturity, it is most probable that young people will marry. And when they have really assumed the responsibilities of family, they begin to experience new values. New challenging forces arising in themselves, perhaps consummated by family, by the advent of children. Now, of course, if the young person has had no background in self-discipline, has never really seen in his own childhood family any closeness between his parents, has never had the observation of seeing sacrifice gallantly given to preserve a family integrity. If there is nothing in his own experience about the strength of family, the young family builder will be at a very serious disadvantage. Against this disadvantage, however, is the social factor. He feels that he has to succeed, because without such success, he loses status. If he fails in a family, it cannot be completely concealed. And while failure is not taken as seriously as it used to be, it is held still as a defeat, as far as the ego is concerned. So the problem of the job, the problem of the additional economic strain of maturity, begins to creep in on the individual. This forces him to take his mind off of himself to some degree. If he is unable to make this transition, then he is a perpetual adolescent. But if he makes some kind of a fair adjustment, he begins to realize that life is serious business, and that it has to be lived according to certain rules. Once having accepted this inevitable, the person begins to experience the maturing of his inner life. He begins to think in terms of those who depend upon him. He cannot entirely avoid the obligations of property owning, of various investments, and the gradual building of an economic reserve. He is faced with the prospect of educating his own children. And these problems immediately divide the men from the boys. Today, a great many young people, both men and women, fall apart under the pressure of the responsibilities of maturity. We find a large group of neurotics who simply cannot stand the thought of the curtailment of their own freedoms. I had a man in not long ago who was gradually recovering from a fifth marriage. He walked out on every family situation the moment it interfered with his own liberties. He could not stand the thought of a dollar that he earned being spent by anything or anyone but himself. Obviously, he was a joy to live with. And his own life had brought this condition. His own parents had begrudged him every nickel they ever spent on him. He had no background of security, and no resources in himself. Now, when a person fails in a perfectly natural and normal responsibility, the psychic hurt is perhaps deeper than we like to realize. We cannot expect everyone to be magnificently heroic, but to have no heroism in one's nature is not very helpful or very acceptable, even to the person himself. He almost inevitably comes to the conclusion that he's a pretty weak person, that he's not much good, that when it comes to a decision, he never is able to make it, and when it comes to responsibility, he is forever attempting to avoid it. To try to live with yourself when you know those kind of things about yourself is not easy. So we have all kinds of escapists trying to run away from the fact that they cannot live with their own reflection in their mental mirror. Here we find many different weaknesses taking over the life of the person. However, if you try reasonably hard, you're also inclined in the course of this pattern to a number of blind alleys. We will assume for a moment that the young person starting out to create a home is ambitious, is conscientious in his desire to provide a good living for his family, and has fair resources with which to achieve these ends. But now he is presiding over a menage of complicated beings. He has perhaps parents to think of. He has a wife to consider, perhaps her parents, and also their children. This is quite a responsibility for a person who has never been really instructed in how to carry the responsibility with dignity. In the course of trying to balance this situation, the homemaker is today poorly equipped to discipline the home over which he presides. Thus, the family itself gets out of hand almost immediately. And instead of becoming a strong pattern of support, becomes merely a continually increasing drain upon the family resources. Every member of the family wants everything. In a very short time, there is the talk of the larger house, then the swimming pool, then better cars, then a car for every child. And so it goes until the producing unit is confronted with a $15,000 to $20,000 investment in the college education of each child alone. This gradually produces a situation that is economically unsound. The individual today cannot meet such a demand without a series of temptations and pressures which are very difficult to withstand. The constantly increasing demand for money may force the person to take on more responsibilities than he is able to carry, may force him to do twilighting and other ways of increasing income, or be in constant conflict with the family because he doesn't earn more. By degrees, the normal, dignified human relationship, which should have brought strength, the family which should have given tremendous encouragement and vital support to each of its members, finally settles down to living off of the other members, each one trying to get the lion's share of whatever there is. This becomes a pretty disillusioning process. And in this period of life, we have a great deal of physical trouble at the present time. We have the ulcers and we have the heart attacks. We have the breakups and the crackups. We have the individuals unable to create a decent home environment because of pressures, and therefore their children growing up to add further pressure and heartbreak to their parents. The situation is viciously out of hand. But as it is at the moment, the average homeowner sees no solution. He cannot tighten his own authority without open revolution. He cannot demand better conditions because he is outnumbered by the entire family group. And each day, more means and ways for spending money are being introduced into our way of life. With everything else, taxes rising, costs rising, demands rising, appetites increasing every moment, and we now accept as absolute necessities luxuries that our ancestors did not dream they could ever hope to possess. So by the time the individual reaches 50, the end of his second little cycle, he is pretty well tired out. Within his own nature, there is gradually rising a revulsion. When he was a child, he didn't know what he was. When he was an adult, he never had an opportunity to find out what he was. And as he passes into the third part of life, he comes face to face with the fact that he himself is the person he does not know. That he has never had any chance to know. But locked within himself are many values which he would like to develop, but has had no opportunity to develop them. Although this condition begins to show itself in the 50s of life, our economic society plays the same trick on this man that it plays upon the young. Young people are biologically mature at 14 to 16 years, but they're not economically mature until 25. The individual in the latter part of life begins to advance into what might be termed the cycle of self-analysis or the cycle of contemplation in his 50s, but he does not retire from business until he is 65. Therefore, a great part of the latter years of his business life are years of conflict. There is no relationship between his psychological age and his economic age. As a result of trying to stretch his money-making propensities beyond their normal span in his psychic integration, the individual at 65 retires under most unfavorable psychological pressures. Instead of being able to retire with a reasonable amount of constructive energy available to him, he is likely to retire pretty well tired out. He has had to continue to follow courses of action that are less and less interesting to him. He is required to continue ways of economic survival, which he realizes within himself will lead nowhere. By the time the person comes very close to his 60th year, he realizes that the great incentive for accumulation is gone, that the great pressure for a career is gone. Now, there are persons, of course, who will never release themselves from pressures. But where an individual in advancing years is still desperately concerned with the affairs of middle life, he is psychologically abnormal. He is not doing the things that are best for him. He is not using life as it was intended that he should use it. But as our way of life is as it is, we know now that arbitrarily, the individual must wait retirement age unless he is one of a small group that can afford to retire when he pleases. Having come finally to this retirement age, the person looks back over his life. For at this time, he is supposed to begin to gain from experience. He is supposed to be able to look back upon a life reasonably well lived. He is supposed to have fairly comfortable memories. It is assumed that he was a good son, a good husband, a good father, that he did these various jobs as conscientiously as possible, that he carried his life along with dignity on a reasonable pattern of consistencies. It is also assumed that he will carry no great grudges against society, but because his moderate interests were within bounds, he was able to fulfill them to a satisfactory degree. Under these conditions, the person should, as he reaches his elder years, have a certain consolation in his own character. He has lived his life as well as he could. He is not too ashamed of it, though perhaps not inordinately proud. He also has theoretically learned from life. He has finally found in the experiences of living the ultimate justification of his philosophy of life and his religion. He should be able, looking back over 50 or 60 years of living, he should be able to know from this living itself that his faith was real, that the laws and covenants of his religion were true, that they sustained him, that he kept them and they kept him, that the various principles that he was taught were the right principles, and wherever he followed them and obeyed them, he flourished. Where he disobeyed them, he was penalized. Thus, out of the years of life, he should have the proof of what constitutes a proper way of life. Today, the individual looking back over his life does not see too much clearly in the form of these directives. He reaches retirement age without any particular faith in society. He does not believe that society was based upon any ethical pattern, nor does he believe that ethics necessarily contributed very much to his happiness and security. He experienced more a life of intense competition and recognized society merely as a tremendous collective force which bestowed upon him little more than exhaustion. So he finally retires. He retires with the full realization in himself, most people have this, that the essential situation now is twofold. First, the light and the load. The person who wanted to accumulate in his younger years suddenly loses the desire to accumulate. If he doesn't lose it at this time, it's a bad sign. He begins to wish to be free from the responsibility of unnecessary possessions. He does not want to own things that he cannot use. He wants a few things that he cherishes and which are companionable to him. But he wants to simplify life so that no longer his energy is exhausted in the protection or possession of things which contribute very little to his peace of mind. So he wants to gradually lift from himself all unnecessary, fatiguing responsibilities. The second thing that he distinctly wants at this time is a sense within himself, a growing sense of his own eternity. The older person must either increase his faith in the substance of things unseen, or else life becomes pretty difficult. He must also undoubtedly adjust more and more to the limitations of his own health and his own energy. For as one English philosopher observed, age comes to every man as a surprise. He doesn't realize it until it hits him. Under these conditions, his philosophy of life is called upon very strongly. In this transition, bewilderment can also take over, and with this bewilderment, a strong antisocial tendency. We have always at this time also the danger of the Faustian complex. That is, the danger of the individual becoming desperate because he has not lived in any mature sense of the word and feels life slipping away from him. this individual tries to recapture youth and embraces death instead. So a great deal depends upon integrating the pattern of life in this older period of living. The end that is desirable and which is theoretically attainable, and which sometime I think we will realize more and more can be attained, is that life itself should be under such control, direction, and discipline that the individual ages completely rather than only in certain areas of his nature. By this I mean particularly that theoretically, most diseases that affect the old are diseases which arise from wrong attitudes, wrong reactions and relations with life, and perhaps strong character defects. These have a tendency to become more acute, more chronic, more desperate as time goes on. And the lack of integration of our psychic nature is responsible for much of the misery of advancing years. Theoretically, if we were able to relax inwardly, we could maintain a quiet, constructive peace with ourselves and our world. There is no reason why, when the time comes, we should not simply sweep our way out of this world in peace. It is because of the confusion, chaos, and inconsistencies in our own nature that we are unable to make so dignified a transition. But it is conceivable that we can have the same experience that Plato had, who at the end of 81 years went to sleep with the books of the Poet Sophron under his head and just did not awake the next morning. He was a life lived in peace with life, a life of integrities, a life of value, a life of quiet internal acceptances, a life guided by wisdom, a life expressing itself through benevolence, through charity, and through patience and quietude. It would be quite possible and conceivable that as man matures his inner consciousness, such a life and such a completion of life is within his grasp. But it is not possible to say it can be achieved at the moment, but that all efforts in that direction may very well ultimately produce good in the life of each person. The best chance we have for a happy old age is to start the moment that we become aware of the need to bring our own temperament onto an even keel. For it is this unevenness that threatens the development and survival of our age patterns. So we have these three divisions of life. And now we want to try to think a little bit about Zen, and what Zen means in these three stages of existence. If Zen stands for one thing more than another, it stands for tranquility. Now, we cannot ask, probably, all young people to take up a study of this kind. There is no particular reason why they could not. There is no reason why tranquility should not be as stylish as frenzy, but up to the present time it has not achieved this dignification. But one thing is certain, something resembling Zen, or resembling a directive for personal integration, should be incorporated into education. It should certainly be present in the two higher years of high school, and it should continue on into the university education. on the assumption that the more education the individual receives, the more important his inner tranquility becomes. Perhaps a couple of years of it would be enough for the average person. But for the scholar, the scientist, the physician, the lawyer, the engineer, the technician, the demands upon his mind are such that his need for tranquility increases with his intellectual growth. This inclusion of a quiet pattern of self-discipline could very well be interesting to many young people. I have observed that a great number of those in their late teens and early 20s are interested in trying to find out something that will constitute a strong, clear, reasonable directive. Many of these young persons will not accept theology as it is now disseminated. They do not really want to be atheists. What they want is a working plan that works. And nearly every human being has a natural desire to respect something. And where he has no outlet, where nothing seems to be worthy of respect, he is injured within his own nature. So I think we can say very definitely that by the time young people graduate from school and begin to establish homes, that many of them would recognize the value of some simple pattern of integration, some rule for growing up in a quiet, orderly way. If such a rule was generally accepted, generally included, and generally admired, there would be no major problem in seeing it brought into effectiveness. It is only when it is an isolated circumstance that the believer is at such disadvantage. Today in the world, particularly and mostly in Asia, there are somewhat more than 5 million Zen. These people constitute a considerable block, although, of course, a very small minority of mankind. But they do represent persons in many walks of life and many different basic convictions. They're not all exactly alike, although they share in this primary belief. In addition to those who are actually Zen, we should realize that this doctrine is derived largely from China and India and belongs to the meditation systems of India. Following through all of the ramifications of the meditation system, I think we can say that in all probabilities, the number of those who are depending upon the integration of their inner resources as a protection against outer circumstances, that this number will probably run to 200 or 300 million. It constitutes all in all the faith of Asia, as contrary largely to the faith of Western man. The faith of Asia is rooted in the discovery of the indestructible self, that this self is not dependent upon society, that this self is a leader and not a follower, but that the leadership of the self is never a leadership into radicalism. It is not an anti-social leadership. It is not a leadership against others. Rather, it is a leadership against weakness, whether it be in self or in others. It is the resolute determination not to be swept away by the common errors of the time, but to build a life upon such principles as are inwardly experienced to be true. Zen, because it is a doctrine of experience, is available to young people in a very interesting way. What are the experiences of young people inside themselves? How many times have they wept themselves to sleep because of the lack of affection in their homes? How many are brokenhearted over the feuds between their own parents? How many have seen those that they are supposed to love and respect perform actions that no normal person could love or respect? How much disillusionment has arisen in the lives of these young people, especially now? Today, by the time a young person reaches 18 or 20, he is perfectly capable of the Zen experience. He is capable of beginning to put in order the injustice, the confusion, the inconsistencies which have enveloped him throughout his childhood. He is also in a position to estimate very clearly the weaknesses of his educational system. He is perfectly able to pick out a degenerate professor from an honest one. He knows whether or not he is being well taught and whether he has a right to respect his teacher. These things he knows within himself. But not knowing what to do about what he knows, he finally gives up, goes along with the crowd, and uses any means that he can to forget his own misgivings. But these misgivings are his Zen opportunity. And if there were means afforded to him to realize the importance of gradually, maturely digesting the experiences that once frightened him, the recognition of the real facts behind situations that have offended and angered him. Gradually, our young person could use his own disillusionments as a strong force in the discovery of truth within himself. One thing that Western man must yet do, and that is to recognize that the source of truth is internal. That while facts may be gathered from the outside, the transmutation of fact into living value must be from within the self. A philosophy, therefore, which causes the person to develop reliance in self, build upon the integrity of self, and learn to depend upon self only in the great emergencies of life. Such a person cannot be disillusioned, cannot be betrayed by any of the exterior circumstances which so terrify those lacking inner foundations. So the young person is perhaps nearer to the Zen than he will be at any other time in life. He has not yet had a time or an opportunity to build so many excuses and defenses that life can never be faced honestly again. He is not caught in a machinery against which he cannot rebel. He has not been locked within a financial structure which he must obey or perish. He is still a relatively free agent. And in that free agency, he has the right to take hold of and come into control of his own life. If in this transition period, before between 18 and 25, the young person was able to establish internal resource, this would accomplish many, many things. First, it would remove forever the condemnation which many hold to their own elders. It would give the individual the insight to know why his parents failed him, and would help him to realize that unless he takes hold of the situation with greater wisdom and strength than they did, he in turn will fail his own children. He then begins to recognize that there is only one solution, and that solution is the taking hold upon reality. To achieve this, he must have, at best, only a hint of the value. If he becomes aware of the fact, he must do the rest himself. There is no possible way in which this process can be systematized into an infallible doctrine or dogma. All that can be communicated is the need. All that the young person can do is to become aware of the meditation system of Zen, realizing that this system, as far as its outer form is concerned, can be communicated in a few hours, but as an inner experience may require an entire life, maybe more than one life. But it is a dedication to the strengthening of value inside. Once having established value, the individual has a rule of judgment. Zen bestows maturity of judgment. It frees the individual from his intensities, but in no way frees him from his responsibilities. Zen is based upon two concepts: true wisdom and true love. To discover what wisdom means is to discover one of the great keys for existence. To discover what love really means is to become empowered with perhaps the noblest concept that man can experience or possess. Zen, having set the person in a very quiet way in the realization that he has the right, the inalienable right, to be right, that no one can take this right away from him unless he voluntarily surrenders it. And anyone who voluntarily surrenders it betrays himself and the person to whom he makes the surrender. There can be no solution through the loss of value. But once Zen is established, it is almost inconceivable that it can be surrendered. The experienced fact cannot be denied, and it would require the complete loss of reason, a terrible sickness of the mind, to deprive the reasonable person of his code of life. How, having set these matters into some kind of a pattern, the individual is then able to move into the second period of life and achieve his own maturity. Even if he does not become aware of some of the problems until he reaches maturity, he still has time. But under the concept of meditation, leadership from within the self, there is much greater and more reasonable probability of the establishment of a good home.